Good morning and welcome to another edition of She Persisted, and happy Friday, everybody. You made it. Oh my gosh, what a week. I got to tell you about my personal life. I got to tell you about my cat. My amazing, amazing cat. So I don't know if you are a pet owner, but, and I know how people feel about cats. They either love them or hate them, but I have both in my house. I have dogs and cats. Well, I had two dogs and two cats. And then it was a couple months ago that we lost one of our dogs. And I say we because Katie and I, even though we're no longer together, I mean, we basically raised all these animals together. So we still have a vested interest, not only in our, you know, two-legged son, but also in our animals. And I know for a lot of couples who break up, you know, the animals are still an emotional attachment for the both of you. And so one of our dogs passed away, and Katie had to take that dog to the vet to have it put down while I stayed home with Mr. Carter. We weren't aware that the vet was going to put our dog down when it happened, but that's how it worked out. So when she got our dog there, she called me and let me know that they were going to have to put her down. Did I want to come by? We had our son. He's only three. There was nobody else to watch him. So I was like, no, you just be with her and you help her transition. Okay. So this week, that was only a couple months ago. So what's left in the house is two cats and a dog. And so I have two Siamese cats and a golden terrier poodle, maybe mix, like just a Heinz 57 dog. But I did adopt her from a golden retriever rescue. So there's, you know, a suspicion that she has some golden in her, but it's very little. I mean, she looks more terrier than anything, but she has epilepsy. I adopted a special needs dog. And then the two Siamese, well, one is 17 years old. Her name's Akima. I named her after a Drew Barrymore character in an animated movie back in 2000. So she is just the best cat ever. And she's tough as shit. I mean, this cat, even Katie was intimidated by her. So Katie's not a cat person. So the cats are really mine. So Akima this week, really all year, has been a little gimpy on a leg. And she went to the vet right before Thanksgiving. I took all the animals to the vet for checkups before Thanksgiving. And she had an infection and they took care of it. And I thought that would take care of like a little bit of the limp because the infection was around her leg. So this week I came home to find her, I mean, laid out. Now, earlier that morning, she had a difficulty eating. She was losing her balance a lot, I noticed, but she was still eating and drinking and going to the bathroom normally. She wasn't able to climb into the litter box, but she was able to use a puppy pad. I put a puppy pad down and my tough as nails, you know, cat knew exactly what to do and just started going on the puppy pad. So I knew the time may be nearing. She's 17. I mean, I've been paranoid about her for years. You know, I think that when you have an animal that reaches a certain age, you start looking for signs. And I'm the worst at, you know, over analyzing the smallest of things. So I came home to find her. I mean, she was laid out. She could barely lift her head. She was crying. Her eyes were just wide and she looked panicked and I thought she'd had a stroke. I thought she stroked out and I gotta do it. So I tried to fight back tears, which were very tough. I couldn't do it. I cried and then tried to get myself together, but I got the cat carrier and I knew this was going to be our last drive. So I literally had prepared myself for that decision. And I told Katie, I'd let Katie know what I was having to do. And I said, you know, I, regardless of your belief system, my thought is in these situations when you're dealing with a pet and having to make that decision, I said, that's like God's decision every day. I don't want that job. I don't want to play God and have to determine when the time has come. But you certainly don't want somebody to suffer. And she looked like she was suffering. So I knew it was time. Made it to the vet. I went to a vet that I hadn't gone to before because my vet is a little further away. So I went to the nearest vet. I walked in the door crying. There was an emergency clinic near me, and I went there first, but they were closed, but redirected me to this other vet. And anyway, I'd never been to this vet before. I walk in the door, I'm bawling. And I said, I think the end has come or something to that effect. Just pitiful. I was pitiful walking in, had the cat carrier with my cat crying in it. And they were just the kindest people. Bless their hearts. The receptionist took me back to a room. The vet came in I said, you know, I think we're here. She's 17, and I think the time is here. And I was just crying. And they handed me Kleenex, and they took Akima out of the cat carrier. And like I said, she was immobile. She was moving her head, but that was it. And they laid her down, and the vet looked at me, and she just, she had, it was almost as if she was trying to choose her words carefully. And I thought, I'm already crying. I've already come to the conclusion that we have to make this decision. And the vet said, well, let me check one thing. And so I kind of stopped crying, like, well, she didn't immediately say, you're right. And she proceeded to ask me several questions. So basically what happened was my vet asked me if my cat, so Akima has had a little bit of the eye shake. I don't know if you have a cat. I've actually known a friend, a sorority sister, who had the eye shake, you know, where her eyes jiggled, her eyeballs jiggled. And so Akima's eyes had that slightly every now and again since she was a kitten. And anyway, the vet asked me about it, and I was like, you know, yeah, she's had that for 17 years. So it ends up that she had vertigo. So I guess Siamese are prone, and some dog breeds are prone to extreme bouts of vertigo. And her theory is that she had not really had this before, but since she was 17, that, you know, the wear and tear that she was getting. I wish I could remember the name of the disease that it's called, but basically it is just an inner ear rebellion. And she said, I think this may be what it is. I do not think your cat has had a stroke. But she said, let me do some blood work to double check. And I sat with my cat. They gave her a sedative to relax her a little bit because she was panicked. And they did the blood work, and her blood work was normal. And I'm only laughing because I was so distraught. And and it was almost like, are you kidding me? And vertigo. So basically, they diagnosed her with this. There's a name for it. I don't have it in front of me, but I'm still so dazed by it. But she spent the night at the vet, and you know, she's still not 100%. Like it's going to take a few days for her inner ear to get right again. But they've given her some medications, and like I said, she spent the night because she was still eating. Even though she could barely move, she was eating from the side, like laying down eating, like a lot of us do when we're watching TV. But she was laying down eating, but she couldn't get water down. She was having a hard time drinking. So they wanted to keep her hydrated. Just long story short, I couldn't believe. I was a basket case walking in there, and I was stunned as I walked out, like, oh, okay, well, I'll call later. Like, I really had prepared myself for the worst, and what an experience. You know, it wasn't elation. I can't say it was elation because she's still not well, but it was a relief mixed with confusion, mixed with, wait a second, I got myself all ramped up, ready, and now it's okay. It's almost like cautious, like, really, is it okay for me to relax for a second? I mean, I know she's 17, and I know that we are on borrowed time, but decision. I'm trying to think how many times in my life as an adult, because when I was a kid, of course, it was mom or dad that made that decision for us, bless their hearts. But gosh, as an adult, how many animals have I had? I mean, think in your life. I mean, how many times have you had to make that decision? And it's just the worst. It's just the worst because it's so unnatural to feel. It feels unnatural to terminate life. But I mean, yes, at least there is that option to be humane, because, you know, Akima, you know, still is, she was scared to death because she was in a constant state of vertigo. So the reason she was laying down and did not move is because she would get more dizzy the more she stood up. So given up, basically. She'd just given in to the vertigo, like, okay, I'm just fine, I'm just gonna lay. It didn't even fight it. So that's why she didn't seem like she could walk, because when she tried, she'd fall over. So she just was laying down and trying to be still, trying to keep the world still. And so she was panicked because she didn't understand why this was happening. And so I told the vet, I'm like, I am so sorry that this is how we met. But you know, under these circumstances, but you've been, she was phenomenal and so kind. I mean, just, And for vets and doctors too, but especially vets, I mean, they have to be psychologists and psychiatrists as well as doctors, because you have these, you know, these owners. I tried to keep my shit together while I was in there. I didn't question her. I didn't argue with her. I didn't, you know, like, I didn't blame her for what was going on. So, like, you know, I think I was probably one of the better cases coming in. I've certainly been in a situation where I've had an animal, unfortunately, be young and suffering and having to go in. And I think I was a lot more rude to the vet at that time, because I was having to do that for, you know, there was one dog I had that was only one when I had to make that decision because she got sick with a virus. But I thought I'd share that with you because I know you relate, because it's just, you know, if, and God bless you, if you're having to, I don't usually say those words, but that's how I feel. I mean, if you're having to make that decision soon, if you've had to make that decision here lately, I'm so sorry. If you've ever had to make that decision, I'm sorry. And you know, that's part of it. That's what I said when we were trying to determine whether or not it was going to happen, was it's a part of it. You know, you love these animals so much, and you just want to do everything for them. And you know, the bad side of the love that you receive from these animals is the fact they don't live as long as you do. And you end up having to make the decision. You have to pull the, you know, well, I don't want to even say that word, but you got to make the decision. So I made the decision this week and I got a reprieve. So I'm very thankful. But 17 years old, I swear, 17-year-old cat, and she is tough as nails, man. We've called her Lazarus several times. I mean, you talk about 9 lives, and I was certain this was it, and she has an inner ear infection. So there you go. Ah, bless them. Bless those loving souls. Coming up next, we're going to talk about sexual harassment, but not everything in the news that you've been hearing. It's a little different take on it, because sometimes sexual harassment happens in an overt way, and sometimes women are being hindered simply by trying to avoid it altogether. And I'm going to give you an example of that coming up next here on She Persisted on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
Now, the top of the hour on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn presents the Green News Report.
The danger zone around the Mount Agung volcano is expanding rapidly.
On the bright side, though, Bali's volcano eruption could temporarily lower global temperatures.
A recent report says hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is likely responsible for a dramatic uptick in Texas earthquakes.
New study finds drilling wakes up sleeping earthquake faults. UN treaty curbing HFCs comes into force. Plus,
this is really just the beginning.
Elon Musk makes good on his battery bet for South Australia.
All of that good making and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We gotta give Trump credit when he deserves it. He pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And I think he should get credit for that, because he said he was going to pull out, and then he did, and that's a refreshing quality in a man.
Yes, it's come to that. We're working blue. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I guess we interrupt this Green News Report for another volcano?
Yes, yes, we do. The ongoing eruption of the Mount Agung volcano on the island of Bali, Indonesia's top tourist destination, has forced the closure of its airport and the evacuation of more than 100,000 people, but it could also have a potential climate impact. Researchers at climate action group Carbon Brief say that if a large eruption spews particles into the upper atmosphere, it could have a cooling effect on the climate by slightly shading the sun's rays. But that would be only temporarily.
Yeah, I think you're digging really, really deep to find some good news in an otherwise terrible world.
Yeah, because 2017 is currently on track to be the second or third hottest year on record, according to both NOAA and NASA.
So bring on the volcanoes.
Well, yeah. Here in the U.S., yet another study links the fracking industry to the 600% increase in earthquakes in Texas. Southern Methodist University researchers analyzing deep geologic faults in Texas found that they were dormant with no earthquake activity for 300 million years. reserves until the fracking boom in the state. The researchers found, quote, no other explanation for the spike in Texas earthquakes except for human activity. The state has not officially accepted any link between earthquakes and the lucrative fracking industry.
No, of course they haven't.
Some good news for the climate. A global United Nations treaty to reduce the use of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, has now come into force with the signature of Sweden meeting the threshold to trigger activation. HFCs, used primarily in refrigeration and air conditioning, are small but very potent greenhouse gases. The Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol means that starting in 2019, developed countries must begin limiting their use of HFCs by 10%, with developing countries like China and India following suit starting in 2024.
Will Donald Trump be able to pull out of this one?
No, he will not. And luckily, it looks like the U.S. Senate will ratify this particular amendment because the chemical industry is already behind it.
Well, there you go.
Some good news and bad news for U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. For the first time since the 1970s, emissions from transportation have overtaken emissions from electricity generation as the nation's top source of greenhouse gases.
Now, has transportation overtaken electricity, or has electricity undertaken transportation, so to speak, because we have cleaner electric generation now?
That's exactly it.
I got it right?
Yes, you have. The good news means that our electric grid is getting cleaner. That transition away from coal for electricity generation toward natural gas, wind, and solar is succeeding as intended in lowering emissions. But the bad news is that we are not doing very well at controlling carbon emissions from the nation's cars and trucks, which are rising again due in part to low gas prices. But innovation in electric vehicle battery technology is moving quickly and may put a dent in that. Battery tech company Fisker just filed patents on a new solid-state electric car battery that they say will have a 500-mile range, and they claim will be able to go from zero to fully charged in just 1 minute.
Wait, seriously? It will charge in 1 minute?
That's what they say.
That's what they say? I'm dubious.
Finally, good news for South Australia. Tesla founder and CEO Elon Musk has made good on his bet to build the world's largest battery farm for South Australia within 100 days, or it would be free. It's now 45 days ahead of schedule. Tesla's battery installation is now up and running, connected to a French-owned wind farm. It is undergoing testing before going live to back up South Australia's electric grid. At the contract signing back in September, Musk called it proof that the future is in renewables.
This is really just the beginning, but I think what this serves as is a great example to the rest of the world of what can be done.
Well, it can be done, and he did it. And this was after South Australia was having all of these problems with blackouts. Will they continue to have them now?
That remains to be seen.
We'll keep watching for much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today. Check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide, please, on your Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Please help Progressive Voices support the Green News Report by stopping by bradblog.com/donate.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1966. That was the day that the registered nurses of the Youngstown General Duty Nurses Association walked out of their jobs. Nursing could be a grueling profession, with long hours of physical labor for low pay. In Youngstown, the nurses were frustrated because there were inconsistencies in pay. Some recently hired nurses made more than those who had been working for years. Part-time nurses did not receive the same wage increases as full-time employees. They also did not feel that they had enough say in delivering quality care for their patients. When they asked to meet with the hospital's executive director to discuss their concerns, the nurses were rebuffed. They then contacted the Ohio Nurses Association Union and asked for help. Youngstown was a steel town, a union town, and the nurses were ready to join in the local labor movement. At first, the Youngstown Hospital Association refused to bargain with the union. But when the nurses threatened to walk out, negotiations began. After 2 months of talking at the bargaining table, major issues remained unsettled, including pay and union recognition. Fed up, the nurses called for a mass resignation. 305 of the 433 nurses turned in their resignations. Two-thirds of them were part-time nurses. They formed informational picket lines outside the hospitals. A federal mediator was brought in to settle the dispute. In the end, the nurses won significant gains. They received a more than 25% raise over 2 years. A grievance procedure was established for the first time, but most importantly, the union gained recognition and the right to bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions for the nurses and their patients. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Hi, Truth Seekers. It's Kathy Malloy. If you haven't heard the Mike Malloy Show lately, this is what you've been missing.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is a man who gazes into the past and sees only a fog of out-of-focus associates and half-remembered events. In his testimony today before the House Judiciary Committee, Sessions may have hit on the new Trump administration defense for the Russia scandal, one that can be applied to almost any future revelation. Its essence is that the Trump campaign was such an ungodly, bumbling mess that it was simply incapable of colluding with the Russians in their campaign to undermine Hillary Clinton. This gruesome little gnome, Jeff Sessions, the goblin. That's it, exactly. Jesus Christ, the way his head stamps around that evil little, you know, he'll look and grin like, I'm going to bite you. I'm going to bite you. I got teeth. I never perjured myself. And you're goddamn, you're a nasty liar if you say I have. Yeah, he and Roy Moore, they ought to put those two in a goddamn sack and throw them in a river somewhere. That's what they ought to do. And you know who'd come out? The goblin. He'd eat his way out the bag. He'd eat right through Roy Moore. But there he was today. There sat that evil goblin just sitting there with that little grin on his face. Don't you want to just take something heavy and get that grin off his face, huh? When he does that little thing, his head swings to the left, then it'll swing to the right. Like, you listen over there. You listen over there? Hey, I never perjured myself. This is not a good day for me, as you can probably guess. I kept hoping against hope for years. When the 60s went, you know what I mean by the 60s, when they went nowhere and nothing changed, and we elected Nixon and McGovern got one state, Massachusetts. And this was after the Watergate break-in. And Nixon took 49 out of 50 states. That was so long ago. I mean, really, what, 45 years ago? And I kept thinking, no, things will change. We'll have some epiphanous moment where all of us together in the United States of, by God, America, will come to our senses and we'll apologize to the people that need desperately an apology, and we'll follow it up with some kind of reparations just on Turtle Island. I'm not talking about out there around the world. I'm talking about just here. And we'll make amends. You'd think at my age I would have given up a long time ago, right? Long, long time ago. Listen live to the Mike Malloy Show weeknights at 6 p.m. in the West, 9 p.m. in the East, only on the Progressive Voices Network. Can't listen live? Download the podcast at MikeMalloy.com. Don't miss a minute of the fun and frivolity.
Whether you are in or out of town on New Year's Day, I invite you to simply watch the Rose Bowl Parade on January 1st. Why? Because I have the honor as a kidney transplant recipient of riding on the Donate Life Float, thanks to my sponsor, Atlantis Piedmont Healthcare. What a cool experience to be in the Rose Bowl Parade. And you can find out more, see what the float looks like, and even become an organ donor at DonateLifeFloat.org. That's DonateLifeFloat.org. Back to She Persisted. I am your host, Melissa Carter. So I have to say, with all the sexual harassment stuff that's been going on, I'm glad that things are coming to light. I'm glad that men are actually being dismissed from their jobs because of sexual harassment. But one of the things that I just hope evolves in this conversation is men making men responsible for this action. And that's why I'm glad they're being dismissed from their jobs, because that shows that men are taking this seriously. It's not women who are these guys' bosses necessarily. I mean, a lot of these guys work for other men, and men are dismissing them from their jobs. So I hope it continues, because what I hope to continue is this idea that men don't want to tolerate this either, because too often women are having to go out of their way to make sure it doesn't happen to them. So we've talked about this on the show before, how there is a mentality that women are victims and men are prey. And that is the standard idea of men and women, that men are just going to go after it. They are conditioned to go after it. Now, I'm stereotyping here, but they're conditioned to go after it. They're taught to lose their virginity as fast as they possibly can. They are taught that to be a man means that you sow your wild oats and you sleep with as many women as possible. To be a man means that you may ask a woman out on a date, and if she says no, ask her out again. If she says no, find a way to make sure that, you know, you get what you want. That if you consistently chase after a woman, because the thrill is in the chase, remember, that you will get what you want. Where women are taught to be the gatekeepers. We're the ones that are supposed to be prim and proper. We're the ones who are not supposed to lose our virginity soon. We are the ones who are not supposed to sow any wild oats. All we're supposed to do is make sure that we stay virgins until that one special man comes along, our Prince Charming, and rides us away on his white horse, and that we're happy forever, and he is loyal to us and will protect us. I've talked about how I have female straight friends who do not feel comfortable living alone. When they're married, they do not feel comfortable when their husbands are out of town. They feel very vulnerable. So there is a condition in which women have bought into the idea that they are victims, that they are the weaker sex physically, and for some, the weaker sex intellectually and emotionally, and that without a man, a woman is just incomplete. And I think that still holds true for a lot of people. There are a lot of people who still buy into that. And I think the avoidance of any issues when it comes to sexual harassment, the burden is on the women. And the burden is on the woman not to be raped. And the conversation is never about how men are the ones committing the crimes. Men are the ones doing it. So they're the cause. They are the cause. So, you know, in cases with sexual harassment, obviously women do it too. But for the majority, we're talking about men. And whoever the cause is, the cause needs to be rectified. The cause needs to be eradicated so that the crime isn't committed anymore. But it just seems the conversation is never about the man taking responsibility, and that shame on him, never shame on her. It's always shame on her. Well, the reason I bring this up is because there is a new study out talking about women and trying to avoid sexual harassment to their own detriment. And there is a case study in India, you know, one of the largest populations. And in India's capital, New Delhi, there are women who are choosing to go to worse colleges than men, despite the fact that they score higher than men on college entrance exams. Now, why is this happening? Well, researchers have found it's because women want to avoid sexual predators. So it's not just about women going to the colleges and dealing with the sexual predators there. The problem is how they get to the university. So the study is surrounding Delhi University, and it is a university based entirely on entrance exams or school exams. And so you are placed within the university based on your exam scores. And women have the ability to be in the top of the class or in the best parts of the university. However, they are not doing that for several reasons. And they said, one of the reasons is just the transportation to get there, that women are spending a lot of their money. Some women are spending as much money as their tuition in order to go on more transportation to avoid sexual harassment, basically trying to find better modes of transportation to get to the university. And they're finding that they're spending more money in doing it. So not only are they not getting the better education, despite the fact that they tested better, they're also spending more money to get to college, and they are just in such fear of the predators. Nothing has happened to these women. So it's not a case in which there has been a rash of harassment and rape and the women are having to avoid it. It's just the idea that it might happen that are causing these women to completely change their futures because of sexual harassment. And so, it shows that there is an underbelly to all this that we really need to pay attention to. Now, I know for me, here in the city of Atlanta, there was an issue with a downtown entertainment center. This has been, at least almost 20 years ago, that in Atlanta, there is a downtown area called Underground Atlanta, which is a really cool area that is underground. So it's shops and clubs and restaurants that are completely underground, but they're it used to be a thriving area, I believe, back in the 70s in the city. But since then, there was crime there because of the placement in downtown. As the city grew, downtown became less popular to people, for homeless population, for crime, and for women in particular, and me included. I was not interested in going downtown by myself in order to go to this establishment. There was new bars opening up, new clubs opening up, new dance places that wanted younger people to come and to party downtown. And I was like, I was not interested, and I represented, I think, a lot of women. A lot of women felt the same way I did, which is to get in a cab. There wasn't Uber at the time. So to either drive down there and find parking and walk over there, or find a cab to come down there, which I got to tell you, no, I don't mean to offend, but the cabs in Atlanta are nothing like cabs in other major cities. It's not quite as sophisticated. But I was like, I didn't want to do it. And it was because I wanted to avoid any opportunity for me not being safe. So I bought into the same thing, that if I was going to, be a part of something like that, I wanted to feel safe. And I was a part of a radio station that geared toward women, and we couldn't do any promotions down there because most women in Atlanta didn't feel comfortable doing it either, because Atlanta is a very transportation dependent city. So it's not a pedestrian friendly city. And so, how you get there does determine whether or not, you're going to go. So I relate to the fact that these women are trying to avoid this, but it's such a shame, because this is a university. This is their future. This is not some nightclub that you go on a Saturday night. But it just made me think about, as women, what we do to avoid being prey to the predators. Just the thought of the predators and in our protection of ourselves to keep us safe and to keep the rape statistics down and the crime statistics down. Does it work? I mean, I guess it's working, but it's still the burdens on us. I really think that this is a case in India, that here we are, like, it's gotten to the point where young modern women are willing to thwart their education in order to feel physically safe from predators. And so that's why I'm glad this conversation in Hollywood and around the country in the United States is coming up. But I hope it continues, because this really needs to change. This is not some dramatic reality show, something that, in the end, we'll just, do the same old game, and these women should never be in these situations and the men can do whatever they want. We've got to teach men to not behave in this way. I mean, I think that, where's that conversation? Where's the conversation about the things you teach young men and boys about how to treat women? I mean, Katie and I have had conversations multiple times about the fact that we are responsible for raising a man. And we're responsible for raising a man that not only is respectful to his community, but a man who knows how to handle his emotions and to handle any negative feelings that come his way, and how to do it without being violent. How to teach a man who is taught to be violent to be a man in this country to not be violent. How do you do that? How do you do that when nobody else is having the same conversation? And so I'm determined to do that. I will do my best to do that. I will do my best to do right by him, because he deserves to have a happy life as a man. And he deserves to have a happy life as a man with another man if he's gay, and with a woman if he's straight, and with both if he's bi. I mean, whatever my son is, I will support what he is and hope that I do right by him. But it is, you know, I love all this girl power that we're seeing in young girls. And I love this, you can do anything. And I believe that. I mean, we believe that. But at the same time, we cannot allow this, you can do anything, but be sure and don't wear that dress and be sure and don't do this and just don't do anything to rile a man up. Just don't do it. Well, I always contend, well, let's talk to the man about, well, why are you using sex as a weapon? So why are you doing that? Why do you feel the need to seek revenge on women of some kind and violence against women of some kind? What are we teaching them? Now, I'm in a household of two women, and we have what I love is carte blanche on how we talk to our son. And we are the gatekeepers in a different way of the information that our son has. So I have to say, at times I'm relieved that there's not a man in the house that is trying to toughen him up too soon. You know, that's one of the things that I already see in his daycare. You know, there are, and not in his current class, but in the past, I've seen evidence of, I can tell when a child, especially a young boy, has been raised predominantly by what the guy wants, and meaning the guy wants him to be tough at 2 years old and exert his toughness at 2 years old. And I just, I've seen it. And so I'm thinking, you know, does it not start there? Does it not start there that you're teaching a two-year-old to be aggressive, to show that he's the alpha male in a preschool class? And where does that lead? And, you know, everything we see is teaching a man to be tough means you have to be violent. I don't understand that. I was raised that way. Look, I'm a Southern girl. I'm a Southern girl raised by a man who had plenty of guns. So I'm not coming at this from someone who is from the outside looking in. I'm somebody from the inside who realizes how ridiculously flimsy that argument is. Now, fortunately, I had a father that was not overly machismo. And, you know, but he certainly did think men should be tough. And he certainly did believe in guns and being tough and Westerns and John Wayne and all that stuff. Like, he believed in all that stuff. And I don't know if that those lessons and those role models have really done us any good, because look where it's led us to. So anyway, I don't know what the solution is, but I do caution women who are raising boys to be sure and not ignore their needs as well. Don't ignore their emotional needs. Don't ignore them being aware of their emotions. Don't discount emotions within men. That is not just a female thing. We do not have ownership, exclusivity to emotions. Men have just the same emotions as we do. It's just how they need to handle them. And I believe that all this violence comes from men who cannot handle their emotions. I wrote an article one time for Huffington Post about sexual assault. And in the time I wrote it, and it's been years ago, but I recounted the number of assaults that had happened in that week. And I believe in the news, just that week, there were 7 or 8 high profile sexual assault cases in the news. And the article was about, are we doing a disservice to men as well as women by not allowing them to handle their emotions? That, you know, you're teaching men to be violent, to be men, but yet when they are really hurting and they're really suffering and they're jealous and they're raged, then we say, you know, what else do we expect them to do? I am not dismissing crimes that men do. I mean, if you rape and you assault and you harass, you need to be fired, go to jail, serve time, whatever it is, because you are wrong and you are a criminal. That is a crime against another human being. But we as a society have to realize that we can't just teach girls to avoid the situation. We have to teach men to stop the situation. They are the cause. Men are the cause of the violence. And women also have to stop being violent to their men. In certain situations, you can't be a woman punching on your guy, and then when he punches on you, violence has got to stop. Violence has got to stop. But especially now when you have these young, bright women, of these women in New Delhi, of these women in India, what are we losing out on in this world because these women are not going to get to their full intellectual potential because they're afraid of getting raped? This is where we've come to. And that's not fair. That's just not fair. So men are going to have to step up. Men are going to have to step up because this is not just a woman's fight. And I'm sick of it just being a woman's fight. So it is Friday. We're going to lighten it up next. My can of crazy is coming up. And I'm going to tell you about an old trick you were taught when you were out partying, how not to get busted by the cops and how it really doesn't work. It's coming up my can of crazy next here on She Persisted on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
Hey, Progressive Voices listeners. I'm Rebecca Vallis, host of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. This week on Off Kilter, I spoke with Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, about how the Republican tax plan is actually secretly an attack on reproductive rights. You can find this week's show on progressivevoices.com or using the PV app. Let's take a listen. You mentioned that the provision that's buried in the tax bill itself is economically redundant and useless. Those are your words from an op-ed that you wrote about it. And I think really kind of put the finest point on it that I've seen. So if the provision itself is useless from an economic standpoint, how does this actually pave a path to overturning Roe? Help us understand that piece.
Yeah, it is useless from an economic perspective, for all the reasons we described earlier. So what it does is acknowledge that prior to birth, an entity exists that has rights and protections, right? And so this is why it's called personhood, right? Like the Supreme Court and the law has said that actually rights basically begin at birth, although there's caveats around abortion that came through Roe. And this would reverse long-standing decades of scientific wisdom, legal framework, and legislation by asserting actually no, that prior to giving birth, your unborn child or your fetus has rights. And therefore, once you have established that independent suite of rights, then you can litigate all sorts of other things, including, you know, outlawing abortion. It's not possible to overstate how monumental this is for the anti-choice movement to have this kind of language places, which then allows them to go through the court system and challenge abortion at every level. And the reason that I think they're being so sneaky about it is because this has been extraordinarily unpopular. Extraordinarily unpopular. They put it on the ballot in deep red states, right, where they thought it would be a slam dunk, in Mississippi and North Dakota, and it loses every time when it's in front of the voters. The House has, you know, sort of had longstanding had a bill around personhood that had co-sponsors, and Cory Gardner, the senator from Colorado, was in the House and had signed on to that personhood bill in the House. When he ended up running statewide for senator, he spent a lot of time backpedaling on his support for the personhood bill. In fact, he went so far as at one point during the campaign in 2014 to say to his constituents in Colorado, "I didn't even know what I was signing on to." Now, of course he did, right? Of course he knew what he was signing on to. And in fact, the organization that sponsored the bill came out and very specifically said, "We had a huge education session with Cory Gardner, so we knew what he was signing on to." But that's an acknowledgement that this is really something that people don't want. And it's something that people don't want for a whole lot of reasons. Once personhood gets established, it has wide-ranging implications. And, you know, let's just start with abortion. The majority of Americans actually support safe and legal abortion. So the idea that you're laying the groundwork to outlaw it entirely is deeply unpopular. But personhood goes well beyond that.
Thanks for listening. For more Off Kilter, find us on the Progressive Voices Network and as a podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter @OffKilterShow and at Facebook.com/OffKilterShow.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show.
So we previously talked about propaganda o'clock. This is the twice a day briefings for President Trump from his propaganda team, where they would bring him printouts of positive news and headlines, pictures of Trump, really, really wacky, right? They would like print tweets from the internet onto physical paper, print pictures or titles from Fox News of Trump looking presidential or positive titles, and hand them to Trump physically. Really oddball, but Trump demands it, or at least someone figured out that it keeps Trump more docile to give him this propaganda folder. We've actually now learned about another layer of this internal propaganda strategy that Trump's team employs with him, which is that the staff insulates him from all polls that have his approval in the mid-30s and instead just brings him good but completely delusional approval polls. They'll bring him, for example, internal approval polls only of Trump supporters, where he has mostly retained support, or polls that are just known to lean very far to the right, like Rasmussen, which recently showed him at 46%. Still no miracle, but higher than the mid-30s that the more reputable polls have been showing. But interestingly, in the last couple of days, even Rasmussen now has Trump down at 41%. It's also been reported that some White House insiders are not thrilled with this strategy. They say, listen, these internal polls are delusional. They serve no real positive purpose. It doesn't do anything for us to show Trump these polls. But the issue is that it's altogether too much time being spent validating Trump's self-image by his staff instead of doing stuff. And I wonder, does Trump really not search Google? Does he really think that every poll mentioned on just about every TV channel is fake? Well, he did once say that. Remember back in February when Donald Trump tweeted, any negative polls are fake news, just like the CNN, ABC, NBC polls in the election? Sorry, people want border security and extreme vetting. How funny is it that Trump denounces fake news, but is kept happy with fake or incredibly skewed news? And meanwhile, Trump's approval rating in the Gallup poll is 38%. It did pop up a tiny bit over the last few days. The 538.com daily tracking of all approval polls has Trump at an average approval of 38. And if it weren't so catastrophic for our country, I would just be laughing about how insecure and obsessed with himself Donald Trump is. But unfortunately, it's having a real impact, right? It's destroying our relationships with world leaders around the world. It's already forced the United States to take a back seat in lots of important discussions. And as I've said, now when the world meets to decide how to deal with climate change, you just don't talk to Donald Trump. You don't need to talk to the American president, because there's no point in it. When the world meets to talk about alternative renewable energy sources, they don't need to get the United States involved, because in the end, it's Trump and he has nothing to add on those issues. So it would be funny if it weren't part of this significantly destructive status quo that we have around the world when it comes to the president of the United States.
You've been listening to part of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/The David Pakman Show.
I'm Susan DiGiulio for Green Under Pressure. Today, my guest is Anthony Swift, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Canada Project. He's an expert on tar sands and the Keystone projects, which are being developed by TransCanada to bring tar sands oil from near Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. We spoke to him just days after the 200,000 plus gallon Keystone 1 pipeline spill in South Dakota. First, Anthony, can you give us a tar sands primer?
It's not what people think of when they imagine crude oil. It's actually something that's closer to tar. It's found in the boreal forest of northern Alberta. And in order to produce it, tar sands producers have to clear cut virgin forests and basically do the equivalent of mountaintop removal to get to this gravel where the tar sands is located. And they use enormous amounts of energy and water to melt this thick, tarry bitumen out of this rock, and secure it to become what they move in pipelines. And all of that waste is left in the oil of northern Alberta, polluting the water sources of the boreal forest and the food sources of the indigenous communities who live in that area. Once tar sands gets to the pipeline, they actually have to dilute it with chemicals in order to make it flow through the pipe. And one of the things to note is this energy intensive and environmentally damaging process makes tar sands the most carbon intensive oil source in the world. Because it is so thick, it actually behaves differently when spills happen. And we found that in Kalamazoo, Michigan in 2010, when a tar sands pipeline spilled about 800,000 gallons of oil into Michigan's Kalamazoo River. That cleanup cost over $1 billion. And then once you get it into refinery areas, it's also more energy intensive to refine and produces more toxic byproducts like petroleum coke. There's been quite a lot of controversy about growing mountains of petroleum coke in the Midwest, polluting nearby communities.
Well, it just sounds desperate, actually. I mean, to do all that, to move, move carbon. It seems insane that anybody would want to do that instead of building, say, several square miles of wind turbines. To be clear, this is the Keystone 1, not the Keystone XL pipeline, but this is the same technology that Keystone XL is going to be using. This wasn't the first spill of Keystone 1 either, was it?
It wasn't. And one of the things to keep in mind is, you know, Keystone XL is still a pipeline that doesn't exist. It's bigger than Keystone 1 was. But Keystone 1 is a fairly new pipeline. It came online in 2010. You know, many of the pipelines in this country average, or the pipeline system in this country averages 50 or 60 years in age. And as pipelines age, they tend to have more problems. But Keystone 1 has had enormous problems from the get-go. In its first year of operation, the pipeline spilled 35 times. And in the last 7 years, looking at South Dakota alone, we had the 210,000 gallon spill earlier this month in South Dakota. Last year, there was a 17,000 gallon spill, and there was a 21,000 gallon spill in its first year of operation in that state. And if you compare that to the safety assurances TransCanada gave us when they pitched Keystone 1, TransCanada said that there would be no more than one spill every 42 years in South Dakota. And that's a particular concern with Keystone XL because it is a much bigger tar sands pipeline, and it goes through some of the United States' most sensitive and rich water resources.
Within days, the Nebraska Public Service Commission held its previously scheduled hearing on TransCanada's proposed route for the larger Keystone XL. What was the upshot of that deliberation after this spill? Did it have any impact on it?
Well, Keystone XL has been a very controversial pipeline in Nebraska simply because the route goes through the Sandhill region, which is one of the most water-rich parts of both Nebraska and the Plains region of the U.S. Unfortunately, the Public Service Commission was unable to consider spills in their determination. They were really just looking at routing questions and where some of the more feasible routes would be through the states. But what ended up happening in Nebraska was really something that might have been one of the worst cases for TransCanada, in that the commission roundly rejected the route that TransCanada had proposed. And then, in a split decision, two commissioners wanted to reject any route for Keystone XL through the state. And the other three ultimately prevailed in approving an entirely different route that hasn't been reviewed, hasn't gone through any legal process through the state. And so this puts TransCanada in a place of enormous legal uncertainty in Nebraska, because the only route that they've been approved to build Keystone XL goes through landowners' land that the landowners who are on this new route don't even know they're on it. Nobody has studied it, and in all likelihood is going to have to go through the same state review process and federal review process that TransCanada's preferred route had to go through.
So, Anthony, we've heard that TransCanada is looking to bring tar sands oil out through California and Washington State because these states have the technology for processing this gunk. What can our listeners do to try to put a stop to all of this?
Listeners can write letters to their state governors and assembly people to support policies that would move California, Oregon, and Washington forward on clean energy technologies and make it more difficult to import high-carbon, dirty substances like tar sands into the state.
Ever really think about what ideas can do? Well, then you realize the size of the thinker does not determine or even limit the size of the idea. Well, that's what my children's book is all about. It's called Whale of an Idea. And if you need a gift for a baby shower or a birthday, I would love for you to consider it. Whale of an Idea, available now online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. 1, 2, 3, 4. Normal people, stupid things. Today's entry comes out of Ontario, Canada, where a guy was pulled over for having a taillight out. And the cops thought, he might be drunk. Well, the guy also clearly thought he was drunk because he popped a penny in his mouth to try to beat the breathalyzer. Do you remember the penny thing? I remember the penny thing. But there were two big problems with this. Now, one, the cops saw the penny on his tongue. At least when I tried to do it, I would put it underneath my tongue. This guy put it on top of his tongue. And two, the whole thing is a myth. Sucking on a penny does not have any effect on a sobriety test. Sorry to tell you. So when the cops asked the guy about the penny that was mysteriously just sitting on his tongue, the guy decided to swallow it. Nevertheless, he was arrested. And probably was arrested because he had a penny on his tongue. Congratulations to this guy and penny popping ways, because you made it into my can of crazy. I wanted to leave you with one more story. It's a great idea, maybe for an animated movie. Call it Amazon Molly. Have you ever heard of Amazon Molly? Well, it is a type of fish that is all female. That's right. This species of fish has survived more than 70,000 years without ever having sex. Now, that's sad. But they lay eggs, which are perfect clones of the mother. That's how it works. It's a fish that basically clones itself, never has sex. There's no Amazon Molly male to hook up with. So it's basically a cloning fish. And it has been around for 70,000 years. Now, researchers got confused because this goes against everything that they believe about evolution and Darwin's theories. The Amazon Molly interacts with males of other types of fish, but it's not sex. When animals reproduce without sex, they eventually become extinct. So Amazon Molly should be extinct. But one doctor named Lawrence Lowe says, without exactly explaining anything, what they have shown is that this fish has something special going on. Well, it's a female. That's why. And he also says there must be some special tricks to help this fish survive. Well, because she's female. He says maybe there is still occasional sex with strangers that keeps the species alive. Future research may give us some answers. Like, he is not convinced that this fish is not getting it somewhere. But, you know, as we've discussed earlier, women don't tell. Because we're not supposed to be doing that, right? But no, seriously, Amazon Molly fish, you should look it up. All female species, been around for 70,000 years, lays eggs just like the mama, and has never needed a man to survive. So thank you so much for joining She Persisted today. We really appreciate it. I hope you have a great weekend. And the secret to having the great weekend is making sure you take care of yourself. I know with Thanksgiving and with the cat, like I've talked about, and with my son, there are times that I get so frazzled in making sure that everything gets done or everything gets put away or the house is in order or my son gets to school and he's got his clothes and he's got this and he's got that and my animals are okay and they go to the vet and they get their medicines and they get okay. And all those things, there have been times where I have not taken care of myself. I have either skipped a medication or I didn't get enough sleep or I did something. And it's in hindsight, I'm thinking, Carter, you can't do that. So ladies, we all make the mistake of being self-sacrificial. This weekend, do something for yourself that will make you smile. And it's only for you. Something that is just for you and doesn't involve anybody else to make you feel special. Why don't you make yourself feel special? That's very important. And today's quote is from Rita Pitka Blumenstein. She is an Alaskan doctor, a tribal doctor, and part of the International Council of 13 Grandmothers, which helps elder women working to preserve traditional knowledge, global solidarity, healing the environment, just basically a native badass. And here is her quote. We create our lives out of our past and out of the present. We are our ancestors when we heal ourselves. When we heal ourselves, we also heal Mother Earth and we heal all future generations. Take care of you. Have a great, great weekend, and we will see you here next week. Bye-bye.